You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. And it is glorious out there.
It is. It's 70 degrees right now as we speak.
And that's going to be the high in a couple of days.
Yeah, this is an interesting weather pattern for Memorial Day weekend. In the nursery business here in California, we kind of go from roughly Valentine's Day to Memorial Day as our big spring season. And Memorial Day varies from insanely busy because the weather is cool and pleasant, people are desperate to get the last of their vegetables planted, to, oh my God, it's hot, we should go do something and jump in a lake somewhere. This is going to be in the insanely busy category of people planting vegetables rapidly, partly because they got such a late start in many cases this year. Lois and I are preparing this for broadcast. Today's date is May 22nd, 2024, for broadcast on May 23rd, 2024. And it is 70 degrees this morning, going up to a high today of 83 degrees and sunny. Mostly clear tonight, 58 degrees. Thursday, the day of the show, 82 degrees. Thursday night, mostly clear, 50. Friday, 74 degrees, mostly sunny. Friday night, 51. Saturday, 71 degrees and sunny. Saturday night, 48 degrees and clear. Sunday, 78 degrees and sunny, and Memorial Day will be sunny with a high near 83 with a low that night 52 degrees, and Tuesday 83 degrees as well. What is going on with this cooler than average weather? Well, we've got a sort of a trough. It's not going to rain or anything like that, but we've got this cooler air passing through. It's wonderful. People are going to be very happy about it. And then we've got a ridge building. So the extended discussion tells us Sunday through Wednesday, ridging returns. When you see ridging in the National Weather Service discussion, that means we may get a north wind first and the ridge will build. There won't be much air movement. It will be warmer temperatures with readings expected to be a little above average Wednesday, Thursday, Friday of the week after Memorial Day. So a very cool, pleasant, balmy weekend coming up. Lots of great planting to be done. Lots of great vegetable plants in stock at local garden centers. If you didn't happen to get your tomatoes or things planted yet, there's still plenty available. And just be sure to water them very carefully, very thoroughly when they go in. Cooler weather means you shouldn't have to check, have to water them every day. Check every day, but not necessarily water them every day. And then we'll be going into a warmer pattern. Interesting to look at one of my favorite sites for graphics, Ventusky.com. Ventusky.com. You can see, using the mix of different climate models that they use, even as much as 10 to 14 days out. Got to use some healthy skepticism as you look 10 to 14 days out, but they are showing substantially warmer temperatures as we get into about the first week of June. If you scroll up and down on their lovely graphic interface there, temperatures over 100 in the valley, interior parts of the Central Valley, and up in the north part of the Sacramento Valley, starting about June 3rd or 4th. First of all, that far out, there's a lot of ambiguity in those forecasts. Also, that's in the valley. As you get down into Fresno, Bakersfield, up into Chico, Yuba City, Redding, and so forth, we're going to be, from the looks of it, in the 90s, mid to upper 90s, in about 2 weeks, which would not be that unusual for June. But it does mean a pretty drastic, sudden change in plant water use. Before we get to that, we should mention a couple of things. KDRT is community radio. That means public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. Big thanks to all of you who donated during Big Day of Giving 2 weeks ago and our spring fundraiser last week. We met our goals. We really appreciate your donations. If you didn't, or if you feel like suddenly you want to give a monthly donation instead of a one-time donation, just head on over to kdrt.org/donate, and you'll find all the options there for a one-time or a monthly contribution. But again, big thanks to all of you for your contributions. And we like to mention some of the other programming here at KDRT. And we usually talk about public affairs programs, but there is some great music shows that are sometimes not just music. And one of those is Cowboy Tracks. You can join Nancy around the campfire to hear authentic Western roots music and cowboy poetry. Something deep in your soul will resonate to stories from the early Wranglers, Mexican vaqueros, Old West adventurers, silver screen buckaroos, Western swing bands, contemporary real cowboys, and all who appreciate wide open spaces, freedom, and the Western lifestyle. That is live Wednesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. Cowboy Tracks replays Tuesdays, 10 to 11 p.m. For the rebroadcast time for all the great programming here at KDRT, just click on the schedule guide.
So there's a lot of stuff that happens in Davis, and it's wonderful to find these things. Now, the Arboretum plant sales are over, so we can't announce that anymore.
Yep.
But Don was looking at the Arboretum website, and he came up to this really cool thing, which turns out is weekly. Don, what is this?
The Good Life Garden, which I was familiar with, but didn't realize they had this ongoing thing that you can do. Okay, Good Life Garden at the Robert Mondavi Institute, which is right next to the Arboretum, basically part of it there. On Fridays from 3 to 4:30 p.m., you can drop in and help out with weeding, planting, and pruning. And volunteers can take home extra produce while learning about edible gardening. Everyone is welcome. No experience is necessary. Tools are provided. Please bring your own gloves if you have them, as well as a bag if you would like to take home some produce. The upcoming event, there's one just in a couple of days, but these are Fridays and May 31st, 3 to 4:30 p.m. The Good Life Garden. Go over there, help out, and take home some produce. Learn about edible gardening. You can get information about the Good Life Garden at arboretum.ucdavis.edu, and just click on the events calendar and you'll find each one of these scheduled opportunities at the Good Life Garden, Robert Mondavi Institute at the UC Davis Arboretum.
Well, looking through the mailbag, I've come to a very interesting message. This is from Roland asking for Bermuda grass advice. And he writes, I have a question about Bermuda grass. I have a Bermuda grass lawn that I'd like to replace. I heard on a recent Davis Garden show that I can overseed Bermuda with perennial ryegrass, but I also know firsthand that Bermuda grass is extremely persistent and hard to get rid of. Can I really just overseed the Bermuda grass to replace it? Will I end up with 100% rye, or will it be a mixture of the two? My main goal is just get rid of the Bermuda, since it's such a pain to replace and manage. If overseeding does the trick, that seems easier than everything else I've heard about, solarization, sheet mulching, all that other stuff. Thank you for your time.
Well, I wish, but what I was probably saying is that it is a common practice to overseed Bermuda grass turf with perennial ryegrass, or in some cases, annual ryegrass. So let's back up a little bit here. Bermuda grass is indeed very, very persistent. There's no other grass you can seed in that's going to outcompete it. So the question is whether you can overseed it with something that will be compatible with the Bermuda grass, make an attractive lawn year round, be tolerant of wear and tear, reasonably drought tolerant, and so forth. I mean, there's advantages to Bermuda grass, but they're, in my opinion, and the opinion of many, rather outweighed by the negatives. Perennial ryegrass is very commonly used for the purpose of overseeding to have a blended lawn of Bermuda grass and the ryegrass. It's done in the winter so that you have a green lawn during the wintertime when the Bermuda grass turns brown. And it can be done in the spring just to have a shinier, more attractive, more lush lawn if that's your preference. No, I'm afraid Bermuda grass will not be crowded out by overseeding with perennial ryegrass. However, perennial rye will hold its own pretty well. So if you seed it in, you'll get a reasonably good blend of Bermuda and ryegrass. It'll be an acceptable turf. And if you mow it high, this is really important, the ryegrass will go through the summer and look good. If you mow low, which Bermuda grass can tolerate, but most other turf cannot, you'll thin out all the other grasses and the Bermuda grass will definitely dominate. It's not a way of getting rid of the Bermuda grass. It's a way of choosing a grass that will coexist with it, make a lusher, more attractive lawn, and also be green during the winter time. Growing up in Southern California, a very common practice there, since the Bermuda grass dormant season in San Diego is only like December to February, it's shorter dormant season than here, very commonly people down there would just go buy annual ryegrass seed annual ryegrass, which is very inexpensive. Throw it on over the Bermuda grass in November at the beginning of what passes for a rainy season down there, and water it a few times to get it to establish. And then they'd have a green lawn, quote unquote, in the winter because they had annual ryegrass, which would then just basically die out as the Bermuda grass would green up again February to March. So that's a temporary greening of a Bermuda grass lawn. Perennial ryegrass is a more permanent greening of a Bermuda grass lawn. You will definitely have to redo it. The Bermuda will gradually outcompete the ryegrass, but especially if you mow short. And this is really important. We're about to go in to our hot season here in the Valley and in interior Southern California and the East Bay and a lot of other places where you're listening. We're about to get quite hot and dry. If you mow short, shorter than 2 inches, shorter than 3 inches, but shorter than 2 inches especially, you'll thin out all those cool season grasses, especially if you do it right before a period of high temperatures. If a heat wave is coming on, don't mow your lawn. Really simple. Don't mow your lawn when it's about to get really hot. The goal of turf management is to never take off more than a third of the leaf blade at once. This is why you mow frequently. But if you mow short, right before hot weather, especially the fescue, which is a really important part of turf blends these days, has a high growing point. You've suddenly exposed that growing point, and it's very delicate. If it's suddenly not shaded and it's exposed to very high temperatures and especially low humidity, it'll wither and die. And many of the individual grass plants in your lawn will suddenly die out, especially the fescue, which is a really important part of our turf blends these days, especially creeping red fescue for shaded areas. So if you go out and you mow down to an inch and a half, because that's what your mower is set at, when we're about to go into 100 degree weather, your lawn will thin out really badly. The one grass that doesn't mind that is Bermuda grass. So you will definitely be encouraging the Bermuda grass if you mow short in hot weather. But in general, mow less often. Set your mower as high as it will go. If you don't know how to do that, ask someone at an appliance repair place to show you how to adjust the setting, the highest setting you can possibly go. And if your regular mowing day is Friday and we're about to go into extreme heat on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, don't mow. Do not mow right before extreme heat, or else you're going to basically end up with a Bermuda grass lawn or bare soil, depending on what's there already. So that's the first thing. You will have a blended lawn if you mow and manage it well for the cool season turf, which is what the ryegrass and the fescues technically are called. If you have Bermuda grass, as we've said many times, it's a perfectly acceptable turf. It has significant drawbacks. It invades your garden borders. It turns brown in the winter and so on. I mean, there's lots of drawbacks to it. But I guess the point I was trying to make a week or two ago was, if you got a high use lawn, you've already got Bermuda grass in there, maybe just live with it. Seed it in with some other nicer looking grass like the ryegrass and the others, but be aware that the Bermuda will still be present. Talking about how to get rid of Bermuda grass is a long program. Okay. We don't have time for that. It involves very quickly either using an herbicide or smothering it. That's what it comes down to. Having someone cut it out and take it away, no, that doesn't work. So there's a lot of labor that goes into it, or use of chemicals that you may or may not be comfortable with. So you read up on sheet mulching and all that stuff, and we've talked about the pluses and minuses of that. Just be aware that getting rid of Bermuda grass is challenging. Even if you're willing to use well-known herbicides, getting rid of Bermuda grass is challenging, much less if you're not. But I would say the most common approach is going to be smothering it out. Or, as I say, living with it in some circumstances.
So on a previous show, Don mentioned how enthusiastic he was about cactuses. And someone wrote to us saying that we need to be careful about where we're getting the cactus from, because there are unethical collectors that go out and dig it up out of the wild and destroy the habitat and kill the cactus, and it's not a good thing. So what Don was talking about was buying it from a store, buying it from a reputable place. Don't go out and dig up your own.
Absolutely. No cactus rustling. Cactus rustling is a big deal. Don't do that. Don't ever collect cactus in the wild.
And don't buy from the guy with the pickup trucks at the side of the road.
Yeah, right.
Pretty sure that wasn't done. But, you know, most of the cactus purveyors here, the people who sell to Don and to other folks, they're doing it from cuttings, from seed. Mm-hmm. They're growing the cactus without disturbing the wild cactus. So, that's that.
Well, I appreciate the comment. It's definitely true. There are big problems with cactus rustling. The cactus groups, for example, the cactus and succulent folks that meet in Sacramento at the Shepherd Garden and Arts Center, folks in that end of horticulture are very aware of this. And there are ethical collectors there, and you can talk to them about their concerns about this. And of course, there's cactus nurseries. We buy our cactus at our garden center from people who grow them from seed and from division. And so buying them from a nursery where you know how they're sourcing them would be very important to do, and know the collectors and talk to them about this. So I appreciate this input, and definitely, you know, the point I was making, and this is true, is that young person beginning to collect cactus, knowing the unusual ones and the rare ones and paying a little more for them at a show, that could be a great investment. It really can, because they increase in their value. Big problem in the Southwest with people going out into thinking it's okay to go to parks and BLM land and dig up whatever they want. No, do not do that. Okay. So yes, we appreciate the input.
Well, let's look at the mailbag. And Annie writes to us, please help. Something has been digging up the dirt in my raised veggie beds. They almost dug up my little zucchini plant and are perilously close to my almost 2 foot tall tomatoes. Do you have any idea what it is? What can I do to scare it or them away? We're in San Rafael zone 16. And she sent pictures. So thank you for the picture. As I look at that, it's a raised bed and it's got small holes, probably, you know, 3 fingers wide, maybe. And, you know, if that was my backyard, I'd be going skunk all the way, because they can smell the grubs underneath the soil and they'll dig down to get that grub because that's what they eat. They're not going to eat plants. They don't care about plants, but they do love those grubs.
It's not just the grubs, though. I encountered this in my own backyard. I topped off a number of my pots. I have 80 or so large containers around my backyard where I do flowers and peppers and things like that. And I topped them off with our high quality potting soil, the highest quality blend that we sell at our garden center, which contains bat guano and seabird guano, among other fertilizer sources, as well as, I believe, dehydrated chicken manure. And I went out the next morning, and at least a dozen of those pots, something had hopped up right in there and started digging in them. Yeah, the smell of the organic fertilizer is definitely known to attract certain kinds of animals. And in that case, it's usually, my best guess would be skunks. My father had this problem. He was an old school gardener who would take a tablespoon of blood meal, dig a hole, put the tablespoon of blood meal down, plant the tomato plant on top of that roughly, and back over it and water it in, and go out the next morning and find the tomato plant, sometimes very carefully dug out, shoved off to the side as the skunk was attracted to the blood meal. So various organic fertilizers, due to their odor or whatever, do attract animals. And my first guess, just looking at the size of these holes and the nature of them, is probably a skunk. In my own property, however, I've had this done by squirrels, which are digging holes in order to plant walnuts or pecans for me. Very nice of them. I've had it done by possums. They're easy to tell because they're really messy. And I've even seen my friendly backyard fox hop up into these containers and start pawing at the soil as well. And I've even seen mockingbirds do it. So it could be any of a number of things. But if you look at the nature of these holes, and this is why these pictures are great, when you have questions about these kind of pest problems, obviously including a picture when you send them to davisgardenshow@gmail.com is really useful. Because looking at these, like Lois, I see small paws. And I see a fairly fastidious animal. This is not a raccoon. This is not a possum. I mean, they're funny, but they are seriously some of the noisiest and sloppiest animals you'll ever encounter. It looks a lot like skunk damage, but it could also be tree squirrels doing it.
And it is not cat or dog, because when they dig a hole, they're usually doing that to defecate.
Yes,
and
you'll find feces.
A pile of feces in there, or maybe it would be covered up. It depends on the animal.
Well, dogs, of course, get in there and just tear everything up. Dogs are not very fastidious either. So this is not a domestic animal, would be our best guess. And when the fox has done it, the fox is very delicate about it. It doesn't do any damage. Skunks, on the other hand, yes, grubs are one of the things they like. Worms, they like to poke around. You find those funny little holes in your lawn every now and then where they've come in and just torn up a little bit of the lawn. That's usually skunk. If it's a bunch of the lawn, that's raccoon. The obvious question really isn't, can we identify the species? Although I think she mentioned that her husband was going to set up a trail cam. That's a great idea. That would be fascinating. Send us the video. We can't wait to see it. But unfortunately, there are really only two approaches that we countenance here at the Davis Garden Show. We're not going to talk about lethal measures or anything like that. Repellents, which frankly usually don't work, or physical barriers to get them to break up the pattern.
Or to not put chicken manure in your thing. You can't do anything about the grubs. If grubs are what they're after, then if there's a grub in there, they're going to go for it. Yep. But if you either don't use that kind of manure, would Don, would watering it in really well wash the scent away?
Didn't in my case. So, but and the problem is, you know, manures are really, really great food sources for plants. But when they're freshly installed, it does often draw wildlife. And I, you know, when I went out and found all these different pots all in one night, I mean, it happened overnight. I did the thing in the evening, went out in the morning, and this had been done. I thought, well, that was extremely annoying. Well, here's the funny part. I filled them back in. I watered them. I thought, all right, well, this will just be an ongoing battle. They came in the next night and did one, and that was that. So whatever it was they were after, they got their fill of it. So it may not continue. But this is the key with animals. You got to think like that animal. They want to think like a skunk. They want to move fairly quickly. Well, skunks are not particularly scared of other animals. They don't want to hang out where there's things that are hassling them. And so they'll just move along. You just want to get the animal to move along. Whether we're talking about a squirrel or tree rats or skunks or possums, you want them to go somewhere else, your neighbor's yard, anywhere else is fine. You want to just discourage them from damaging that. If they're scratching under your nearby shrubs, you don't particularly care. It's just the garden bed that you're concerned about. Typically, what I've done when we just reach a point of extreme frustration. Let's say you're planting tulip bulbs.
Oh no.
You might as well put up a sign that says buffet, all you can eat over here, put an arrow on. So when we've done them, even at our garden center, we'll put them in containers and we'll forget to do something. We'll come in the morning and they're completely torn up overnight. Something has come in overnight, or we've even seen squirrels doing it right in front of us. We cover them with mesh, with wire mesh. That's it. That's simple. You just make a little cage that goes right over it for the time being. And what we do is we just do something you can set in place. You don't have to secure it for the whole season. You just have to leave it on for, let's say, 7 to 10 days. Don't let the plants grow through it. 7 to 10 days, just kind of molded it. We're usually using the same kind of what they call hardware cloth, which is a weird name, wire mesh that's malleable, so you can shape it into like a dome or a rectangle or something and just set it in place. If it's a big persistent animal, you may have to set a weight or something on it. But we have found just covering it, just so they can't get at that soil for a few days, usually takes care of the problem. There are a variety of repellent products on the market. In my opinion, none of them work, but I've heard things ranging from Irish Spring soap to cayenne pepper. There is a spray called Red Hot Pepper Wax, which is cayenne pepper in a wax spray solution. So they dig in there, they get it on their paws. If they happen to notice and their little brains connect to where they were digging, then maybe that'll work. General feedback I've gotten on repellents is they don't work real well, but people who live in deer country or places where they're constantly battling animals will try repellents and find some that work in their particular situation. But a barrier is your best answer.
So Don, you said don't let the plants grow through it, but why not just put a barrier down that's, you know, right at the surface and let the plants grow through it? And then wouldn't that work?
It will, but you'll really regret that at the end of the season.
Why?
Pulling it out is a nightmare. It's all tangled. It's all tangled. People, you will usually just throw the stuff out at that point.
I see.
So yes, it doesn't hurt the plant. You're right. It is a possible option, but at the end of the season, you have this kind of big harvest mess. So best to just put it on there temporarily. Take it off. That trail cam will be really handy when you take it off and see what goes on. But my experience with this, being a rural resident who has lots of wildlife coming into my backyard, just a physical barrier is what you need to do. And that's that kind of mesh. It's like chicken wire, but finer. Even chicken wire would probably work for most of these things, actually. Just something that you can bend easily and set in place and just cover them for the time being. People are dealing with squirrels, tree rats. The problem can go on all the way through the growing season, so they often end up caging in their whole garden, which is, you know, not that hard to do, honestly. But in the case of a temporary thing like this, my experience is it doesn't go on and on and on. They usually found what they wanted or didn't, and they move on to some other part of your yard or your neighbor's yard. Change their behavior pattern. Just get them to move along. That's all.
Well, you know, skunks in our area, they live in one habitat.
Yep.
In the summer and a different one in the winter. And my house happens to be on the path going from and to one end. So I can tell in the spring, because I can smell them.
Yes.
That they're coming by, and that'll last, you know, maybe 1 or 2 days or nights rather, that I can smell them. And I don't know how many skunks are coming through, but mm-hmm. I've had then in the fall, smell some more. And that's the only time that I'm going to get skunk damage in my garden, my yard, wherever, is as they're passing through. Mm-hmm. So there are places where they are resident, and yes, they hang out all summer or they hang out all winter. And then there's other things. I don't know. Down in San Rafael, I'm wondering if they might have, you know, some ferrets or weasels.
I don't think so.
Some other civet cats. I don't know.
Well, skunks are very well adapted to urban areas. I mean, growing up right near UCSD, our neighborhood was there, and a skunk walked through our yard every single night. We watched it go from the avocado tree to the loquat tree to the crinum lilies to feed on snails. Hey, good news, skunks eat snails, and right on out. And my dog interacted with that skunk about every 2 weeks, one way or another. My old Australian Shepherd just had this background odor of skunk. It was sort of a permanent part of his smell. And even him running out and trying to chase it off didn't particularly deter it. If they keep coming back and finding a food source, they will keep coming back. So you need to just break that up. They're not going to come into a yard where they're not getting anything. But when you've got, you know, an avocado on the ground and loquats around the corner and skunks eating snails, well, there's quite a buffet there for them. Anyway, physical barriers, sorry to say, are likeliest to work for you. Now, those of you who have problems with cats coming into garden beds, which can be a real challenge, and I see people just get irate about this, but you're not going to stop the cats from existing outside. I don't want to get in the middle of that argument. I have feral cats on my farm. They also come into my backyard. Physical barriers work, but one thing you can do there is you can typically just take shish kebab skewers. Bamboo shish kebab skewers. Do I have to explain what those are? Sharp pointed things. Stick them in the ground, point up, a whole bunch of them in the bed, such that a cat cannot conveniently walk through the bed without encountering them. And I pretty much guarantee the cat will find some other place to go to the bathroom. That's one option. The second one is something a customer suggested to me years ago. She prunes her roses in January, as usual, and saves the longer canes and just stacks them up. And when she needs to put something in the bed that will keep the cats from walking in, she takes these dried, thorny canes of the pruned roses and just lies them down in the bed in such a way that the cat will find it very uncomfortable to walk through the bed. And that has worked very well for her. So these are anecdotal approaches. Basically, just make it hard for them to get in there and do this step-by-step process of going to the bathroom that they want to go through. They'll go find some other place to do it.
And don't worry about being mean to the cats or getting them with thorns. It's not like you're hitting the cat. No. It's going to go and it's going to start to step and go, wait a minute, I don't want to step on that. Yeah. And take its paw back and not do it. If you ever grew up in snow country, and you ever watched your cat, when you open the back door after a snow and it goes to walk outside and there's two footprints and that's it, because immediately retracted itself and went, I ain't doing that.
Put that litter box down again, please, Mom.
Yeah. I suppose that if there was a place that you didn't care if they went to the bathroom, you could just get some cat litter and fling it out underneath a particular bush.
Oh, they'll find a place. That's no problem. I wouldn't worry.
No, I know. But I mean, if you want to try and direct them.
I see. Redirect them. There you go. Yeah. It's another form of physical barrier, but it's a fairly simple one. I've always thought that rose cane idea was pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, and so Annie, please do, she writes, my engineer husband just set up a critter cam so we can see what's trampling through the raised beds before we put up a barrier around them. So please send us a picture or the video or whatever.
Who knows, it could be a bobcat. Yeah, you could have a mountain lion.
That's too big.
Yes, right. Correct.
Because the holes are smaller than that. Right. So she does have a second question. Something else has been making holes in my zucchini plant. I just put out beer in a pie pan. I'm the one who sent the slug picture in a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, that was great.
I floated a little olive oil on top of the beer to attract earwigs. Is that right?
That's probably not going to work as well as a straight oil trap. So earwigs are out now. The things that are out making holes in leaves it's a long list. Katydids have hatched. They hatched about 3 weeks ago. So they're getting about an inch long now. And they land, and the grasshoppers are very similar. They land, they make a few holes, they move on. You don't find them. And they're there during the daytime, not at night. There are cucumber beetles have shown up on some of my, I'm finding them on my rose petals. There are various other beetles that are out there making holes. But the main thing in the month of May, one of the main pests that we have in our gardens is the European earwig. And earwigs do come out at night and they do feed. And you'd be surprised how many you'll find if you go out at night with a flashlight, which is what I really recommend doing to figure out exactly what you're dealing with. If this is a garden where you can go out at night, not like a community garden or someplace where you have to go to it. If it's actually in your backyard, go out with a flashlight. Earwigs will be out anytime from 10 o'clock all the way into practically sunrise. And people wonder how you can get so much damage on something like a marigold or a zucchini, and then you go out and you find, 12 earwigs on each plant. There are years where they're worse, years where they're not so bad, but they do make small holes and they go back to them and they increase them, and they do come out in great numbers in the month of May. Good news, after about 6 weeks or so, they tend to disperse. So the damage is primarily when we're putting out seedlings, unfortunately, but it doesn't typically continue all through the summer. It's a early season problem, at least in our area. And I've had years where earwigs were very, very bad and years where they were barely there at all. There are things that feed on them, but not very many natural predators of earwigs. A couple things to know about them. They're very attracted to oil, fragrant oil, aromatic oil. So instead of floating the oil on the beer, which probably didn't work as well, a bowl with just a film of something like olive oil or some particularly aromatic oil like that. This is not the time for your safflower oil or something light and delicate. You want them to smell it. Corn oil works well. And just put that in a bowl right near the plant where you're getting the damage at sundown and check it again in the morning. And you only need like an eighth to a quarter inch in the bottom of the bowl. You can use a flat, anything that holds it is fine. They slide down into it, they drown, and you'll often find 20 or 30 earwigs in there in the morning. That's how you know you have a severe earwig problem. Earwigs, you'll actually get pretty good control just by doing that. There are baits out there, just as there are snail baits out there that are organic. The one for earwigs is a snail bait they've added spinosad to, which is an organic insecticide. So they've taken iron phosphate, which is what's in sluggo, and added spinosad to it for earwigs and sow bugs and other insect pests. And so you put that out if you want to, but start with the oil trap to monitor, or go out at night with a flashlight, because I think it's really instructive. And when I do go out at night with a flashlight and I know I'm having an earwig problem, I wear a glove on one hand and hold the flashlight in the other, and I just pinch the earwig in the middle, which kills it, and I can kill them that way. If that grosses you out too much, at least you can use the flashlight technique for monitoring and put out bait or oil traps to try and kill the insects. But be aware that this is a time, like so many pests in the garden, this is a time-limited problem. Starts usually about the 1st of May, goes into about the first week of June, and then they tend to disperse. Also, they're coming from a den that's somewhere nearby. And so you tend to have all the damage more at one end of the garden than the other. And if you can figure out where they're harboring, so for example, a pile of wood, some nursery flats, really common in my situation, nursery flats with pots that are sitting over at the edge of the garden when there's some moisture there, lift it up and the earwigs go scurrying away. If you can clean up around those places where they would harbor, that can reduce the numbers right there. An old technique for managing earwigs is to take rolled up newspapers. Remember them? Remember when a newspaper arrived on your driveway once every day? Well, you got a lot of them, and you take a rolled up newspaper with the rubber band still on it, and you just set it near your plant before dark, and you open it up in the morning and out fall a dozen earwigs. And if you happen to have a bucket of water with a little soap in it nearby, you can take care of the problem that way. So these are very simple methods for controlling them. I guarantee they'll come back. I guarantee they'll continue to do some damage. But here's the thing, they're small holes. The plants will almost surely outgrow it. So monitor, kill ones you can, be aware that it's time limited, and be aware that a squash plant with good vigor, you're just not going to have a problem as you get further into the season and closer and anywhere close to harvest.
Two questions. First is, I'm seeing this is on leaves. Mm-hmm. They don't actually attack the fruit or the vegetables, do they?
They could, but it's later in the season and they're not there usually by then. Yeah. And they can climb. This is the other thing. We'll get like holes on hollyhocks and they're 5 feet up on the plant. What? How can they get up that high? Oh, they climb. They're very motivated. Apparently they like hollyhocks. Just,
So then the second question is, I'm looking at this picture. I am so glad people are sending us pictures. This is so nice. And those leaves have holes in the middle of the leaf. It's not coming on the edge where I would expect something to start eating. It's like they went to the middle and carved something out in the middle.
They can start up.
Is this specific to this critter, or are there lots of things that
snails can do that too? Yeah, one of the first things I look at when someone brings in something with holes in it is what's the size of and the nature of the hole. If it's all on the edges, that's almost always weevils. They can own weevils will climb up a plant, and you'll often find them. They have a little snout, and they'll climb up a plant. Black vine weevil is a good example. Fuller rose weevil. They'll go to the edge of the leaf, and they'll just start feeding there. So what you get is a sort of a serrated or damaged leaf, but no holes in the middle. Snails and earwigs have stronger mouth parts, and so they can crawl right where they want to. My impression with earwigs, thinking like an earwig for a moment, is they go along the vein because they can crawl on the vein. They can get purchase with their little feet, and then they find a place where they're comfortable and feel safe, and they just start chewing, and they can chew right in the middle of the leaf working from the vein. So it's very common to see the hole in the middle of the leaf with earwigs, and as you note, other insects can only get started on the edge of the leaf, and some of them, like, you know, leafcutter bee, they can only start a hole by sawing from the edge of the leaf. Weevils only feed from the edge of the leaf. If it's a big hole, it's got a big mouth, like a snail. If it's a smaller hole, it's got a smaller mouth. And then where it is gives us a little guidance as to what the problem is as well. But also just knowing the seasonality of particular pests. Right now, things are feeding on rose petals. Those are a particular type of beetle. Right now, things are feeding on young seedlings. Those are likely to be earwigs. We are seeing cucumber beetles. So they're showing up. They fly in. They land on a leaf. They make holes at any point on the leaf. They don't particularly care where they start. They look sort of like a green and black spotted ladybug, but they're even more elongated, and they are chewing holes in your plants. So those are present right now. There's not a lot you can do about a bug that flies in, does some damage, and flies away. They're right up there with the katydids. By the time you see the holes, they've already moved on to something else. And so, you know, people used to like spray their whole yard with Carbaryl to deal with problems like that. I really don't suggest that. We don't garden that way anymore. But most of them, that's a kind of a transient damage. So again, unless it's continuing, I wouldn't worry too much about it. Earwigs can get pretty severe some years. We've had years where we had very serious outbreaks of them here on our farm. And so we would trap them and monitor for them and sometimes use the organic baits. But again, telling myself, even as I see a lot of damage on the leaves, this plant will outgrow it, and the problem will pass. This is not something that's going to continue in our area right on into the summer. By the time that squash plant is producing, there shouldn't be any earwig damage. A little later in the season, mid-June and on, is when the younger females head out to try and find a place to make their own den. That's when you start finding them in your garage or trying to come into the kitchen or, you know, becoming a household nuisance pest. They don't do any harm in the house, but people are pretty grossed out by this particular insect because of its claw-like structure on the back of it that looks pretty formidable. You know, just throw them outside or kill them if you're so inclined. But that's because they're dispersing, trying to find a place to start a new den. When I had an ongoing problem in my greenhouse at one point with earwigs coming out at night and feeding on all my young seedlings, this was several years ago, I realized I had inadvertently created a habitat for them by leaving a bunch of wood on the ground where it was moist underneath the benches. And when I cleared all that out and all the pots out, my earwig problem went away. I had essentially taken away their den at that point. So looking for their habitat, cleaning up around the garden area can be very helpful to reduce the places that they can harbor.
Looking at our mailbag, we have a message from Caroline in Davis, who writes, I'm not sure if you've checked this out, but there's a guy in Vacaville Fairfield area that grows Italian melons that function as excellent cucumbers.
Yes.
I heard him on the Joe Gardner podcast in a couple of years ago, and then I looked into his website. He's here in our area. Last year, I bought the striped Porosello words. Anyway, these seeds from him, and they were fantastic cucumber substitutes. I'm growing them again this year, as well as Diva cucumbers. But last year, the Corosellos outperformed any cucumbers I've grown in a number of years. Maybe it's just me. Seems like this right up Don's alley. So I thought I'd bring it up in case you haven't heard about him yet, and then gives a URL.
Yeah, let me see if I can find some seed. The Armenian cucumber is in that category. It's actually a melon. My kid's favorite cucumber isn't actually a cucumber. Armenian cucumber is giant. That's one of the reasons when he was young, my son really liked the Armenian cucumber. You could get 3 feet long and they still were perfectly good. It's a melon that's not sweet. And it's got the texture of a cucumber. It doesn't have the flavor of a cucumber. It's much milder flavor at best, but it's something that's great in sandwiches and things like that. He loved the fact that he could take like a 2-foot cucumber and just start gnawing on it right out in the garden. So Armenian cucumber is in that category. At almost every garden center sells Armenian cucumbers. Interestingly, most of them don't know they're not cucumbers. Most of them just think this is some giant form of a cucumber. If you let most,
they're not bitter and they don't cause gas.
No, they're never bitter. They have very small seed cavities. You can allow them to get as big as you want to on the vine. They're extremely vigorous. I've never had a mildew problem on Armenian cucumbers, and I'm guessing that this gentleman's melons that are like cucumbers are probably in that same category. The only thing I would say about them is these are extremely vigorous. The Armenian cucumber will grow 15 feet with no problem, and it will stay on a fence pretty well, but prefers to just run across the ground. So you have to give it some kind of support. And I'll be growing them again this year because the kid and kid's friends and family all like that same one. It's not my favorite because it doesn't have the depth of flavor that other cucumbers have, but it's never bitter. It's easy to grow. It's vigorous. It's productive. So I might contact this gentleman and get some of his seed and see if I like some of the other varieties. They're certainly attractive and easy to grow. That's one thing I will say. The others, you mentioned Diva. Diva is a great cucumber. I don't even grow regular old-fashioned green cucumbers anymore. I've stopped. I've given up on them. I started gardening here a long time ago, and I would grow cucumbers, one of my favorite summer vegetables, and a lot of them would be bitter. And you go online or you get the extension publications, they always tell you it's because of your watering. It's a watering irregularity. Well, you know what? No. No, that's not true. Because I have had them where I've carefully controlled the watering, and we still get bitter fruit on some of the old-fashioned regular green garden cucumbers. The correlation I have found is with high temperatures. So when we have a heat wave, I know that the cucumbers, regular form that I harvest, within the next week will be bitter. And it is a stress reaction, the presence of that particular bitter compound in the fruit. Now, I did learn years ago from a real good cook that it's concentrated at the stem end, not the blossom end. So you just keep cutting off from the stem end and touch it to your tongue until there's no bitterness. You can use most of the cucumber that way. But you know what? Persian cucumbers are never bitter. Burpless cucumbers are never bitter. Lemon cucumber is never bitter, so I just grow those. And the burpless also, to me, includes the Japanese cucumbers, the very thin-skinned ones, the ones that you see sold as gourmet items in the grocery store. Very productive, really easy to grow, always sweet and flavorful here, and I just don't even bother with the regular green cucumbers anymore. If you're at a store and you're looking for one that really impressed me, Beit Alpha, B-E-I-T, Alpha. Beit Alpha is one of the burpless types. A single plant that I put in about the 1st of July last year produced 12 cucumbers. A single plant produced 12 cucumbers, and that was planted as late as the first week of July. Cucumbers will produce 30 to 40 days after planting. So you can keep planting them all the way till almost September here and still get good yield on them. And as I say, just in my opinion, unless you're pickling, in which case the bitterness doesn't seem to be a concern, just plant these other types, the Persian, the burpless, and these melon-like things that are sold and used as cucumbers. So we appreciate that input, and I'm going to see if I can get some of that fancy seed and get some of those going in my garden.
Don, it's spring. Well, maybe it isn't spring. Maybe it's summer. I don't
know. It's almost summer.
It's time that it's not going to be raining. That's really the
key. That's for sure. Yes.
And so I want to talk about some general watering ideas, some techniques, some concerns, whatever. And I, just so that the listeners hear this one more time, you don't water a plant on a drip system 10 minutes at a time. Because
it doesn't
put out enough water to do anything.
Well, let's back up here. I've been planting a lot of my tomatoes over the last few days. Middle of May is when I put many of them in. And when I plant a tomato, I get done, I plant 7 or 8 of them, and I go back and I give each plant 2 to 3 gallons of water all at once when I plant it. That's to get the water down, since I'm putting them down at the bottom of about a 14 to 16 inch hole, since they're coming out of 1 gallon cans, I need the water to go all the way down to the roots and past and out. 2 to 3 gallons of water all at once. I have the chance every week practically to talk to one of the folks that sits at the Master Gardener's table at the Davis Farmers Market and answers questions from the public. So we swap notes each week about what people are asking about. And this guy said that at this point, His first question to almost everyone is, how are you watering? Because they'll come up and they'll say, I planted cucumber plants, they're barely growing. I planted tomatoes and they've barely put on any growth. They're looking kind of burnt. They're looking really stressed. And you'll say, of course, how are you watering? Oh, we're using a drip system. How long do you run it? 10 minutes a day.
Oh.
And that's very common, okay? So this seems to be a popular setting, and 10 minutes with a conventional drip system is a big coffee mug of water for the plant. I mean, at that. Most drip that people are using these days, the most common brand, Netafim brand, puts out 0.4 gallons per hour from each emitter that's already in the tubing. It's emitterized tubing. That's what people are typically using in their vegetable gardens, 0.4 gallons per hour with an emitter about every foot. So the young tomato plant that you just put in might have two of those near it somewhere, so 0.8 gallons per hour. To get a foot of depth requires a full gallon of water. To get a foot and a half of depth so those roots can go deeper would require a gallon and a half to 2 gallons of water. You're only putting out 0.8 gallons per hour. So to get the sufficient depth with your drip system, you'd have to run it for about 2.5 hours. And when he says that to people, their eyes get wide and they are stunned to think that your vegetable plants would need this much water. So here's a simple data point. A garden needs about a gallon a square foot a week. A gallon a square foot a week. And that's about the same that you're putting on turf. Your garden uses as much water as your lawn. Not that you're using as many gallons for your garden as you are for your lawn, because your lawn is 1,000 square feet. Very few of you have 1,000 square foot vegetable gardens. Your vegetable garden may only be 4 by 10, but it needs a gallon a square foot a week, at least. For the plants to get deep rooted, you need to do that early in the season. So when I put these tomatoes in, I'm giving them 2 to 3 gallons of water. In my soil, which is a silty loam and holds water well, I have found, except when we get a dry north wind, that'll hold me for 2 or 3 days. So I can go back again, let's say 3 days later, and give it another 2 to 3 gallons. A tomato plant gets 5 to 10 gallons of water a week. The lower end is for determinate types that are small plants. The higher end is for indeterminate types that are big plants, but 5 to 10 gallons of water per week. You can do the math with your own drip irrigation system, but really it's easier to just run it for a really long time. Go out there with a probe of some sort the next day and see how far down you got water. Yeah, you can use a water meter. You can use moisture meters. Buy good ones that are metal and cost you $50 to $100. Don't use the little cheap ones that are used for houseplants. Or you can take a trowel, or you can take an 18-inch screwdriver, or you can take a bamboo stake and push it into the ground and see how far down it goes easily, first of all, and pull it back out and see whether it's damp all the way down. But the key is to make sure you're watering at least 18 to 24 inch depth for your tomato plants, for your squash plants, for your melon plants, for your cucumber plants. As my season goes along, I generally have split between the deep-rooted plants, tomatoes, winter squash, pumpkins, and the shallow-rooted plants, peppers, eggplant, beans, cucumbers. The shallow-rooted plants get watered every 3 days or so. They could be watered daily. That would be fine as long as they get enough depth of watering, but 2 to 3 day intervals is actually fine for those. The deep-rooted ones, I can go a full week in my soil and water 2.5, 3 hours all at once, real deep watering, almost as if they were young fruit trees or something like that. And then I can go a full week before I water again. But remember, we were just having this conversation, this master gardener and I'm talking about a garden in a garden bed, not a raised planter. And so the second question he has to ask is, are you gardening just out in the open garden or do you have a raised planter? Raised planter, you'll probably need to water every day. My friend, Fred, who does a radio show, Fred Hoffman, first built his raised planters and found that with the soil he put into them, which was really high quality, almost like potting soil, and drip irrigation covering the whole thing, he ran it 30 to 35 minutes every day, and got great results that way. And I added all that up and thought, okay, 30 minutes every day, 7 days, okay, so he's doing 3.5 hours a week. I'm doing 2.5 to 3 hours a week. Not that big a difference, honestly. I can just do mine all kind of at once, and he can't do his all kind of at once because he's got faster draining soil. But if you want to take that number, 3 hours more or less per week would be way better if you do a deeper watering when you do than these light, shallow waterings. If you're watering your drip system less than an hour, you're probably not even giving a shallow-rooted small plant enough water. And I know that sounds like a lot of water, but produce requires a lot of water. I mean, if a plant is drought-stressed, stressed, it will not yield well. If a cucumber is drought stressed, it'll be bitter. If a plant is not allowed to grow its roots deep like a tomato, it's not going to grow as well, yield as well, and so forth. So I'd rather have people who are trying to conserve water, have them grow fewer tomatoes well than a lot of tomatoes poorly. I would rather have you plant a determinate type and harvest it all at once in August and process it and freeze it than try to limp along growing a bunch of plants without enough irrigation. Drought stress clearly affects yield. We know that. It also affects quality. And so you might as well just do a smaller garden to conserve water than eking out little dribbly bits of water to the plant as the season, as the season goes along. So water big plants deeply and go as infrequently as you reasonably can.
Well, if I look at the messages coming in, I see one from Sophia. And she says, "Dear Don and Lois, I hope you are well. I love your show and look forward to it every week. I recently moved to Lodi, California, and realized that there are watering restrictions. For example, I am only allowed to water my plants or lawn on Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday from 6 p.m. to 10 a.m. I learned about these restrictions the hard way through a warning letter because I was trying to establish my new lawn and garden, fruit trees and roses. As the weather temperature has become warmer and the Delta breeze is picking up, I'm noticing my lawn and plants are not thriving as much due to, I think, how I am watering. I am watering twice a day, 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. for 6 to 10 minutes each. I increase the time because the weird soil isn't as great as holding water, especially with the Delta breeze. Yeah. How can I keep my lawn and plants happy with the hotter temperatures while up against the water restrictions? Any advice is greatly appreciated." And then she adds a PS. Oddly enough, the weeds are thriving. Yes. How do I keep the weeds back without using harmful chemicals? Pulling them every week is not my favorite thing to do. Thank you for what you do for us gardeners.
Well, okay. With respect to the weeds, if you take a few pictures and send them along, each weed has its own management strategy. And this is the important part, is that some weeds are very deep rooted. Some weeds are very well adapted to living on winter rainfall all the way into the early to mid summer. Star thistle is a good example. They get a taproot that goes down when there is winter moisture there, and they can draw on that as they go into their flowering mode. So without knowing exactly which weeds you're dealing with, I'll give you the general strategy. Bury them. Bury them in something.
Come again.
Yeah, arborist wood chips, whatever works for you. It's is whatever you can use to cut and bury first, depending on what it is. So if we can figure out what you're dealing with, you're going to need to water longer than what you're doing. That's not enough irrigation by any stretch for any vegetable that I can think of. You need to run several cycles on the same day if necessary. Your infiltration rate is, if it's slow, if the water puddles and runs off, then you have to back off on each irrigation, but you can have several sequential irrigations on the same day, 5 a.m., 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and so forth. Water restrictions often are time of day. They'll tell you can't water between these hours and these hours, so you need to do it in the nighttime, late, like say 4 a.m., 6 a.m., something like that. Look at your own restrictions and see what they are. But you're going to need to put on more water so that the plants can go 2 to 3 days between watering. Mulch can make a huge difference. Mulching after you've got everything planted with almost anything. Straw is my favorite because it's easy to use and it shades the soil and it helps retain moisture. But if you've got arborist wood chips or something else, I'd prefer it to be an organic thing that breaks down and builds the soil rather than something like bark, which just is sort of hydrophobic and doesn't break down very quickly. But whatever is convenient for you, mulching can make a big, big difference in retention of moisture, allowing you to go longer between irrigations, but you still need to put enough on when you do. So the length of your run is not long enough for the types of vegetable plants we're talking about. I don't know about Lodi, but I do know that in Davis, when we've had watering restrictions, drip irrigation systems and things like them are exempt. So because maybe this is the logic, because drip generally runs for a very long time and it is at ground level and there's no evaporation, the restrictions on time of day in Davis and the restrictions of day of the week in Davis don't apply to drip. So if you're listening in the Davis area, you can water with your drip system anytime you need to because of the efficiency and the efficacy of that particular method of application. We couldn't tell, took a quick look at the Lodi City water restrictions, whether drip is exempted there, so I don't know. But in any event, if you can only water 3 days a week, you can get a good, successful vegetable garden watering 3 days a week if you apply enough water when you do. My guess, 45 minutes to an hour each day that you're allowed to water, maybe more, But you obviously, what you're describing, you'll have trouble doing that all at once. So 20 minutes, 20 minutes, 20 minutes, all the same day. As early in the day as you have to not be violating the water restrictions. And again, I would check with the city and see whether drip or soaker systems are exempted from this particular restriction because they're so much more efficient. But you can, 3 days a week, you can actually have a very successful flower garden, vegetable garden. And by the way, all those other things, your lawn, yes, your lawn's gonna be a challenge because of your runoff problem. You'll have to do some measuring and figure out how you can get a half to three quarter of an inch of water on the lawn each time you do it without it running off. Runoff is the big deal on these water restrictions. Typically, that's the thing they monitor. So you'll have to do some, you know, set some cake pans or tuna cans out there and see how much water you can put on all at once. And we can talk about your lawn watering perhaps in an upcoming show. But you will find that you will have to break up the irrigation applications in order to get to soak in and not run off. Shrubs, roses, if I could get everybody listening in the valley or interior parts of California to water thoroughly once a week for your woody plants that are established, that would be amazing. But that means you have to water long enough when you do. The watering 3-4 times a week is not necessary for most shrubs, for rose bushes, for most perennials, things like that. Almost anything I can think of, with the exception of newly planted plants or really sensitive things like ferns and such, once a week would be enough if it's really thorough. And you mulch around them when you're getting into the irrigation season. End of May, early June is a great time to apply a couple inches of mulch all over your garden and landscape.
And given that so many places have water restrictions these days, if you do move to a new place and you are planning on putting in a lawn, you might want to think about timing it so that you're not going to run into the problem of I can only water it 3 days a week, but it's a brand new grass seed and it really should be sprinkled every day for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, you would do that in the fall or the early winter, and then you would just water for the first period and it'll establish through the rainfall period. That's one of the reasons we typically do lawn renovations October, November here in the Sacramento Valley and other parts of California. November is when our rainy season really begins, so you can water each day that it isn't raining. Usually the water restrictions, by the way, are removed in the winter anyway, and you can get the lawn established. Of course, what the city would like you to do is rethink your lawn. And there's lots and lots of information about that, but going to a lower water grass, there's lots of choices there. Buffalo grass, using more fescue and less bluegrass and so forth, going to a non-turf alternative. That can seem like a big daunting project. You feel like you have to completely reconfigure your sprinklers. No, you just have to run them differently. You can actually use your existing system to change over your landscape to more of a meadow. Question is what your homeowners association will think of that. So you might want to get those rules figured out first as well. But there's lots of non-turf alternatives, and there are even some turf alternatives that, you know, such as the fescues or the buffalo grass or options that you might want to look at. Each of them have advantages and drawbacks. We've talked about a lot of them on the show over the years. If you go to my business website, redwoodbarn.com, I have a whole page of links about drought articles, because in 42 years in business, we've been through 5 major droughts. And so when we get into those droughts, people ask a lot of questions about plants that are suitable and lawn alternatives, and then it rains and they forget about it and we move on. So you'll find lots of articles there with pictures of ground covers, low spreading shrubs, which can make a beautiful front landscape. It depends on your use pattern, but this might be the time. It's May. Start doing, giving some thought to possibly getting rid of your front lawn, and we can talk about alternatives there. But let's find out what those weeds are. Let's find out how you can irrigate more successfully with the things for food, and we'll talk more about that, obviously, as we go on further into the summer. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.